From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Spalding Gray is writing his first novel. He's also performing a new monologue about all the interruptions that prevented him from finishing the novel. On today's Fresh Air, Spalding Gray performs an excerpt of Monster in a Box. Also, we meet actor Jeff Goldblum. He was the scientist turned fly in The Fly and the arrogant magazine writer in the movie The Big Chill. He's starring in a new comedy called The Tall Guy. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Portraits and Self-Portraits, a new recording of musical character sketches by the late composer Virgil Thompson. And TV critic David Bianculli previews The Civil War, a new series premiering on public television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush told reporters today that he still hopes for a peaceful resolution of the Persian Gulf crisis. He said he was determined to wait for the United Nations embargo to force Iraq to withdraw from Kuwait. The president's comments came after a meeting with congressional leaders in which he pressed for swift action on extra funding for the American deployment in the Middle East. Mr. Bush said he stressed the importance of forgiving Egypt's $7 billion military debt and approving sales of almost $20 billion in sophisticated weaponry to Saudi Arabia. Iraq has ordered the defense attachés from the United States, Egypt, and 11 European nations to leave the country within 1 week. Terry Phillips reports from Baghdad.
So far, Iraq is giving no official explanation for these expulsions, but local diplomats believe it is in retaliation to similar actions taken against Iraq by the European community several days ago. A spokesman for the British embassy here says their attaché was already planning to go home in 2 weeks, but now his replacement will not be allowed to come in. Also today, the Iraqi information minister announced his country's war plans.
A short war by the airplane, it is not suitable for us. So we will attack and attack and attack all the forces of America and other American friends there, and the war will be for a long time.
Latif Jassim says America's defeat will lead to the liberation of Mecca, Medina, and Palestine. For National Public Radio, I'm Terry Phillips in Baghdad.
The Soviet Parliament has delayed voting on a plan to introduce a market economy to the Soviet Union. The vote was postponed until next week because not enough delegates were present. The Soviet Prime Minister, Nikolai Ryzhkov, is urging the Soviet Parliament to approve a compromise plan for economic reform. He says that unless a switch is made to a free market system, the Soviet Union will be in a grave situation. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
Mr. Ryzhkov is keenly aware that the argument about how the country's economy should be revived has become in part a debate about the future role of central government in the Soviet Union. He said he fears the program already approved by Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Yeltsin, which Parliament is now considering, is simply too radical. By trying to change too much too quickly, he says, it would bring chaos. But he knows that the plan, by giving more power to individual republics, would erode the authority of his administration. And he must fear that if a program of which he's been such a bitter critic were to be adopted, he'd be forced to stand down. His appeal for the reform proposal to be watered down is certain to be seen by his critics as a straightforward attempt to save his own career.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 6 points today to close at 2,512.38. Volume was 201 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's no one like Spalding Gray. For over a decade, Spalding Gray has been chronicling his life in a series of autobiographical monologues. He's part memoirist, part actor, part journalist, avant-gardist, and comic. Spalding Gray, alone on stage, telling stories of what's happened in his life lately, is funnier than most big-ticket Broadway comedies. But his confessions have the depth and insight to leave you emotionally moved. Some of his funniest stories have been about trying to fit into Hollywood. Maybe you've seen him in Beaches, Clara's Heart, True Stories, or The Killing Fields. Of course, the movie that best showed what sets him apart from other actors was the film of his monologue, Swimming to Cambodia. This was a monologue about the making of The Killing Fields. His new monologue is called Monster in a Box. The Monster is a 1,600-page manuscript, Gray's first novel. The monologue is about all the interruptions that kept preventing him from finishing the novel. Gray is performing the monologue this weekend at the Painted Bride Art Center in Philadelphia. In November, he'll open his show at New York's Lincoln Center. We invited him to perform an excerpt of Monster in a Box and to talk with us about it after. Here's Spalding Gray.
So I got this contract to write this book, and it started to turn into this huge autobiographic novel, and I knew that that's all I wanted to do, because I had this idea that I'd been doing monologues for so long that I was too extroverted, and I want to get more introverted, in touch with my private self, and work in a more private way of writing, and I thought, I'll just do the book. In order to do the book and be private, I thought I would apply to a writer's colony, and I applied to the McDowell Colony in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and I thought, if they accept me, that'll prove I'm a writer. And they did accept me, and I was very excited because, well, a number of great writers had gone there, including Thornton Wilder, who had written Our Town and had modeled the town of Peterborough, New Hampshire, as the town for Grover's Corners. And I arrive at 600 acres of land with about 52 private cabins on it. Each person has their own little house to work in, and it was wonderful. You could do anything in that house. I mean, no one could bother you. There was no telephone. They brought you lunch and delivered it in a little basket, put it on the steps and tiptoed away like Yogi Bear and left you alone. You could do anything in that house, which was fantastic for me to consider being in a house and being able to do anything I wanted in New England. That was unique. So I began the writing process, and basically I hated it. It was dreadful. I was writing 3-4 hours a day longhand, doing the book longhand. I mean, I wanted to isolate myself up there, just write. No living, just writing. And I'm writing away, and I'm beginning to have my knuckle swelling from the pressure of the pen. My knuckle is swelling up and becoming arthritic from so much writing, and then I'm beginning to lose my sight in my left eye. And this makes me very upset because the book I'm working on is all about my Oedipal themes, and I think, oh no, there goes the first eye. So I'm writing, and then when I can't write anymore, it's 3 hours, 4 hours, I'm walking. What do? I walk in the woods, and I walk, and I walk, and I get back to the main house where we're supposed to eat dinner, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I get up in the morning, and I write, and I walk, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I get up in the morning, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I write, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I eat, and I reread what I wrote, and I drink, and I drink, and I drink, and I was thinking, anything, get anything, please, something get me out of here. Someone call me and get me out of this place. So I got a telephone call at the main house asking me to come out to Los Angeles to do a project that the Mark Taper Forum Theater had applied for a grant to have me out there to do a year ago. Wonderful. They had applied to the National Endowment for the Arts. That was back in the old days when the NEA was doing wild and crazy things like that, investing in people like Spalding Gray. And the idea was that I would come to Los Angeles and look for people who were not involved in the film industry and interview them on stage. It was to be called L.A. The Other, just talking to simple folks about living in L.A. I was supposed to ride the buses of Los Angeles to find them. So I thought, this is wonderful. It will get me out of here. I'll work on my book in the morning in Los Angeles, and then in the afternoon I'll go looking for L.A. The Other. So I get out there. The Mark Taper Forum rents Renee Shafransky and I this Hollywood bungalow in the Hollywood Hills, a tiny little house, and the one thing I find fantastic, it has a view. I never knew how important a view was to me. I mean, in New York City, I have a view of a roof, a tar paper roof in another building. At the McDowell Colony, I was looking out at trees. Suddenly, I have this view of a snow-capped mountain in 20 miles in the distance, a city with a mountain by it with snow on it, when you could see it, the 7 clear days of the year. And I'd wake up in the morning, and it was beautiful, the birds chirping and the wind chimes, and see the sun coming through the bedroom window. And I'd get up and go in to my writing table and sit down with my book and feel the sun coming across the desk, across my arms, and follow the sun around into the living room and sit down and watch the sun come through the cypress trees and watch the sun come through the palm trees and have a cup of coffee and have another cup of coffee and watch the sun come round and come through the dining room and watch the sun go down through the dining room window and have a martini and watch the sun set into the Pacific Ocean and have another martini. Why go out? Why bother? Why work on a book?
Spalding Gray, performing an excerpt of his monologue, Monster in a Box. So you've got 1,600 pages, which I believe are now sitting on your editor's desk.
Right.
What's the plan?
I just lost one editor, Knopf.
He
went back to school. He dropped out and went back to architectural school. But he didn't, I knew something was going on, weird, but you know how they don't tell you until it's happening. So he was doing the best he could to collate it with me. And what we were doing was talking about where it needed bridges and what were chapters. And also one of the things I was struggling with and learning more about is that I can't do the long digressions that I do in a monologue, in a novel, because it's hard to hold the audience. I had a 250-page digression in which I started telling the story on the beach in Australia and went for 250 pages just telling the story. And I realized that my body, my presence, is a duality in the monologue that I really like. I'm always grounding the audience. I'm always there physically, and I'm not in the book. So that was a struggle, and we were working with that. Then he quit, and I got assigned the hot editor, Gary Fitzdijon, who did Jay McInerney and Raymond Carver. And I thought, well, this is good. He's not of he's not in my kind of sensitivity scene. It's a little bit more Hemingway cowboy-esque, but Gary was hip, hot to do it. That's the only word I can use. So I dumped the whole thing on his lap on June 25th, and he hasn't gotten through it yet. And he promised that by the end of my tour he would, and he claims he's working on it. So maybe this thing is just asking too much. You know, I'd have to hire a real editor that really, really loved me, because it's like choking a horse, this damn thing.
let me ask you to describe briefly what the novel is about.
Yeah, it's an odyssey of a guy, as I refer to him, a guy who's trying to become a man, by learning the art of hanging out and taking pleasure and joy in the simply being able to be alone in a vacation setting or a paradisical session. His one problem is that he's never really worked much before, so it's kind of a contradiction in terms to say that he wants to learn how to take a vacation, but I like the title, Impossible Vacation. And he feels that he can't commit to the woman he's with, Cleo, his girlfriend, and try to settle down and have a family until he takes this one last big trip alone where he learns how to be a guy hanging out, and he's set on doing it in Bali. And he's taking the money, finally, that his mother's left him after she committed suicide. And then it's all of those misadventures on the way of this odyssey in which he remembers back. It's flashbacks of remembering. So it's about the women in his life, of which there are three major relationships. His mother, a woman after that, and then Cleo, the one that he's with then. And so that's kind of the plot. And then it's about every kind of phobia and digression. And it's about obsessive behavior and drinking and obsession with beer and getting drunk and all of those male things.
And all those things
and
that
sex,
you probably have, right?
And masturbation, right? And all of those things. All of those that I had now. I've stopped drinking, and because of that, and I'm older, so I masturbate lesser. Maybe I don't know what's caused the decline in masturbation. I think it was an eye operation I had on my left eye, actually.
So experiencing pleasure is something you have talked about in your monologues,
right,
as always having problems with. You're always looking for the perfect moment, never quite finding it. Did you take a vacation this summer? Did you get away?
I took a vacation, but it was for 10 days, and it was the strangest one I've ever had. It was in Amagansett on Long Island in a small cottage, very teeny, little shack on a salt pond, very beautiful setting. And I didn't vacate. You see, I gave up drinking for the first time, alcohol, since 1976. And I have never lived in a summer in my adult life where I didn't at least have a lot of white wine with fish. I mean, they go hand in hand. And I was also told by one doctor, I've been to many, there's a whole other monologue in that, that I had a high level of mercury, so I had to cut out all big fish because that's problematic with the cataracts. And so all of a sudden, there goes tuna fish, swordfish, and salmon. And I'm out there in the water, and I'm not drinking, and I'm getting prepared for an eye operation, so I could hardly call it a vacation. So Renee said, well, we'll try to take one to Costa Rica because the beaches are beautiful in January after you finish your long run at Lincoln Center. So, and when she said that, the beaches are beautiful, Costa Rica, I got panicked because, again, I feel that enormous pressure to have these ultimate perfect moments, and I don't want to do that. What I'm leaning more toward in my life now is, and I'm reading more and more Zen books. I mean, I think that's foolish. People who read Zen, they should be practicing it, but I'm reading the books, getting ready to practice it, trying to find a more middle ground of the ultimate challenges, the wonderful Zen story where the kind of flamboyant, magical Hindu is saying, boasting about how he can materialize jewels out of the air and walk on the water. And the Zen monk says, well, that's nothing. I do the ultimate miracle. When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep. So I think, well, if I can slow down and begin to experience simple joys and have everything more polymorphous, permissive, and everything like a vacation, that's what I ideally like. rather than this crazy thing of working and then trying to relax with a capital R, which is what America is all about and why it's so crazy. So I just don't know. The idea of a vacation frightens me. The best vacations for me are working on films, when I'm on a film set and I'm doing a small role.
Right, because you don't have to work that hard.
It's enforced, and you're with interesting people in a nice location, and they're feeding you well, and they're taking care of you, and then you do 2 or 3 days' work.
And you're under no obligation to really enjoy yourself, because after all,
right.
You're working.
That's right. The obligation, exactly. That's what gets it.
Does knowing that you're reporting on your life ever enhance the pleasure of it, or do you think it distances you more from
it? I think it distances me, and, one of the particular books I was reading on Vipassana meditation this morning, and I'm starting to get more interested in that, was that they say, are you one of those people that when you're walking in the woods, you're thinking about what a great story this will make for your friends? And I underlined that in green ink, and I thought, but wait a minute, that is my profession after all. And after all, I do enjoy telling stories, and after all, I'm very present when I'm telling the story. So what I see myself as doing is that's a form of sacrifice. That's part of the work. But I do find it's a distancing.
Spalding Gray is my guest, and he's currently performing his new monologue, Monster in a Box. He's performing it now in Philadelphia. In November, he takes it to Lincoln Center. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Actor and writer Spalding Gray is my guest. Was there ever doubt in your mind that you would be doing another monologue? It's been several years since your past.
There's always a doubt. There's always a doubt. And now that I'm doing this one, there's a certain regeneration of productivity where I feel another one coming up behind it like a burp, and or like planes on a runway. So I think I'm back into it again, but. I don't know. I never know when it's coming until this burning issue that comes up, or where I've done something large, like climb a mountain. Writing that book was climbing a mountain for me. And now there's this thing that's happened to my left eye, which was enormously disturbing and changed my life in a major way, because I didn't expect anything to happen to me until I was 50. My girlfriend's mother is always saying, from 50 to 55 is the Bermuda Triangle of health. And if you get past 55, you'll live to be 80. So I was believing this. So, but I got it at 49, and suddenly that caused a lot of shakeup and a lot of investigating around what caused it, what were the issues, what did various people think about this. And that investigating has led to more journals and a lot of information that I could probably do an hour's worth of material for an audience next week. It's that close to being born as a new monologue.
What's the problem exactly with your eye?
It's rather esoteric, although I'm told by the doctor that it's quite common now, or more common. But what happened was my vitreous humor liquefied, the vitreous humor in my left eye, and it pulled away from the retina and left a big piece of it on the retina, so on the macula, which is center of the retina, and I had what was called a macula pucker. Now, everyone laughs at that because it's not like my lawyer says, yeah, I had a girlfriend named Macula Pucker in high school. She had syphilis. You know, this kind of thing. But macula pucker is that you have to look at the retina. It's like a screen, and the jellies on it, that tissue, is making it pucker up and bunch like a piece of saran wrap bunching. So you have enormous distortion of vision. And what they have to do is peel that with microsurgery if you want the operation, if you want to take the risk. They actually cut into your eye in three places and peel that tissue without touching the retina. And I did a lot of shopping around to find the right surgeon. And I knew I had the right surgeon finally when I was waiting in his waiting room the last day to see him, and they had just dilated my pupils, and no one else was in the waiting room. It was a Friday morning. And this little man comes out of my doctor's office. It's like an old-time movie. He's moving very sporadically and fast, and he's got a Nixon mask on. And I think, what in hell is that man doing with a Nixon mask on this day and age? And, of course, my eyes were dilated, and he comes closer to me, and I realize it is Richard Nixon. And he comes right over to me as if he's going to say, I saw Swimming to Cambodia and loved it. But then I realized that he was waiting for me to ask him for an autograph. And I looked up stunned with my eyes dilated going, and I went, oh, hi. And that's all I said. I went into my doctor's office. I said, was that Nixon? And the doctor said, yes, nothing wrong with him. And I said, well, there is no justice in the world, is there? And then the doctor got very defensive. And he said, well, there is nothing wrong with what Nixon did when you consider what Reagan did. And it occurred to me at that point that I did not want to know my surgeon's politics.
So did you have the procedure already?
Yeah, I've had it August 7th.
And you're fine?
I'm healing. I'm back to 20/40 vision, but that's non-correctable. But it was better than what I had. I had 20/200, and I can cover my right eye, and I can tell who you are, although it's not... What happens is I've lost the definition because the macula is responsible. But finding people that had this was such a task, and I didn't. I couldn't commiserate. And I put an ad in the Village Voice.
Really?
It said, macula pucker, ? Does anyone have one? Let's share notes. And no one wrote in, so I got really frightened. And then I finally found a woman that did have it, and she decided not to have the operation because she had helped found the emergency room at Roosevelt Hospital. And she said, if you knew what I knew about the inside of hospitals, you would not risk this operation. So I ignored what she said and went through with it. And I didn't get infection, and I'm better. I'm getting better.
Now, you're the kind of person who is always sure they're coming down with something, right? Or something's going to go wrong.
Well,
or,
I'm what you call a hypochondriac.
Right.
I have those tendencies. I think very narcissistic people have them all the time.
So what's it like for you to actually have a quantifiable, definitive problem?
It was so strangely good. And you can tell by talking to me that I'm not real depressed about it, because it was incredible to have. And all of this stuff came into play around the book, because I talk about losing my sight and writing Oedipal themes and thinking that it had to do with that. But when I talk about getting my anxiety into focus, all of this I imagery comes up, because I am getting my anxiety into focus. And so suddenly that helped. I woke up in the morning and I knew specifically what to be anxious about and how to go about dealing with the problem. And this was very refreshing in a weird kind of way. It was strange. It really drew everything together, and all the other things were gone.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because you had something to focus all that energy into.
Yeah. And of course, you get into a thing where you start playing around with praying to God, saying, all right, if this is what's got to be wrong with me, fine, but let my kidneys and my heart and my lungs go on till I'm 80. You know, you think that just because you get the one thing wrong, that everything's going to go fine. But it was a trying time, but also a very focused time.
I've been watching your performances for a long time. I remember back in, I guess it was 77, you did something called Rumstick Road.
Right.
And it was a two-person piece.
No.
Three persons?
Four, actually.
Four,
if you count
okay.
The technician who was on
which
stage.
I didn't, yes.
Right. He was supposed to be part of the show.
Well, anyways, this was largely about your mother, who was a Christian Scientist, and her suicide.
Right.
And it was presented more, like tragedy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was drama. It was not a humorous monologue
right.
in any way. Over the years, I guess as time has gone by, you're still talking about your mother
right.
in your work and her influence on you and her suicide. But it's taken this kind of dual nature.
Yeah.
It's both tragic and comic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about how The
process of that.
Yeah, the process of humor
that's,
starting in,
but that's
to enter into something.
That's an interesting and good question. And I've talked about it a few times when I've done public talks about the work. But I think that I went through an extremely healing process through art in regards to the suicide, because I did go through the depression, not being able to mourn it, and all of the stuff that they talk about. And when I co-founded the Worcester Group with Elizabeth LeCompte in New York City in the Performing Garage in 1977, we were working on a series of autobiographical pieces. And that sprung me out. And every night at the end of that, I would walk out like Jimmy Durante in three spotlights and wave goodbye to the entire, you know, even now I get choked up thinking about it, to the audience, to the group, and walk out the garage door, the performing garage door. And around that time, 1979, I was doing my first monologue. And I didn't know that they were going to be funny. But my New England timing, my New England accent, my New England understatement was funny to all the New York Jews. If I had stayed in Boston and done them, no one would have laughed. You know, it saved me. The New York audience saved me and gave me my sense of humor. So that helped birth it.
I've got a kind of weird question for you. It's the Willem Dafoe question.
Yeah.
Willem Dafoe, I think, still lives with Elizabeth LeCompte,
right.
who you used to live with,
right.
and you used to collaborate with on your performances, and now he's become a big movie star.
Right.
Whereas you've been in the movies, but you're, I think, still best known in a lot of ways for the stuff that you're doing yourself, for this like really offbeat kind of storytelling that you do. Do you ever wish for the kind of life that he has? Because I wonder if you feel like he's your secret sharer in some way, like the alternate life you could have had.
I don't think I could have had what Willem has, although I long to have it sometimes because it looks like looks good when I'm schlepping around, living out of a suitcase. And other times, my stuff is so fulfilling that I always know that my work is fulfilling when I'm not looking elsewhere, and that's a good percentage of the time. But I don't feel replaced by Willem because he's a completely different. One of the things Willem does very well is work in front of a camera. The camera loves him, and he loves the camera. He's less effective on stage live when we're working with the Worcester Group. He doesn't have the same presence and aura, although he's good. He's much better on camera, particularly in Last Temptations of Christ. I thought he was excellent. One of the things about me in Hollywood, and I've said this recently in interviews, to paraphrase Bob Dylan, Bob Dylan says, "I may look like Robert Frost, but I feel just like Jesse James." I paraphrase it to say, "I may look like the American ambassador's aide, but I feel just like Woody Allen." And what the problem is with Hollywood is they're always casting for type and look. And Willem has a very versatile, good look to do, tough guys, Christ, what have you. I'm stuck in this kind of New England WASP Brahmin where they're casting me as lawyers and doctors and gynecologists and American ambassador's aides. And inside is this very ironic, perverse sense of humor that has never found its right role in film yet. And I think it would have to be built around me. So I think I envy Woody Allen more than Willem, because he really has made his own genre around himself, and I think that's the supremo act to do. Willem still is not in control, you see. He's in control as long as he's marketable. But Woody Allen has got it all down, and I have it down in a smaller arena, and I'm still happy with it.
I just want to check in with you on one issue, and that is, are you and Renee still thinking of having children, or is that
we're doing more than thinking.
You're having one?
Yeah, no, we're working. We're not thinking about it. She now knows when she's ovulating, and so that's when we either have sex or make love. It's more like having sex because it's very clinical. Now I'm ovulating. Now see if you can get some of that sperm into me. So now we're that much closer to it, and I'm much more open to it than I have ever been in my life, because I've really reached a place now where my work, I trust it. I trust it to come. I trust the process. And I trust that attempting to have a baby is everyone's, or many people's story. It's the history of the human race. So there's another monologue.
And if there wasn't, would you feel different about it?
If there wasn't a monologue in it, yes, I would feel. I mean, one of the reasons I started doing monologues was to save myself from the fear of chaos, that things would not be redeemable through some form. And in my case, it's the storytelling form that redeems all things except perhaps my own death. And then with the proper medium, I may be able to tell about that.
Spalding Gray, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks a lot for coming.
Well, thank you. It's good talking with you.
Actor and writer Spalding Gray, he's on tour with his monologue, Monster in a Box. It opens in November at Lincoln Center in New York. Next time, tenor saxophonist Stan Getz. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Portraits and Self-Portraits, a collection of musical sketches based on such people as Aaron Copland and Alice B. Toklas. They were written by the late American composer Virgil Thomson. Also, we meet actor Jeff Goldblum. He starred in The Fly and The Big Chill. Now he's starring in a musical version of The Elephant Man in the comedy The Tall Guy. And TV critic David Bianculli previews public television's new series, The Civil War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. The U.S. is expelling three Iraqi diplomats following Iraq's announced expulsion of diplomats from 11 European Community embassies from Baghdad, including three Americans. Meanwhile, President Bush today tried to downplay speculation that the U.S. is moving closer to war with Iraq. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president said he's still committed to the U.N.-backed economic sanctions as the best way to force Iraq to leave Kuwait. Speaking to reporters on the south lawn of the White House before departing for his weekend retreat at Camp David, the president said the sanctions will take time to work. The president said he is concerned about Iraq's potential for sponsoring terrorism and what he called the systematic dismantling of Kuwait. When asked whether the U.S. is closer to armed conflict with Iraq, he replied,
"I don't intend to be sending a signal that I'm shifting more towards the military, if that was your question."
However, the president said he would hold Saddam Hussein responsible for any terrorist actions against American citizens. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
President Bush plans to meet with Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze later this month to discuss the Persian Gulf crisis when both men visit the United Nations in New York. The president will also meet with Japan's prime minister, who's promised $4 billion in military assistance to aid the multinational effort in the Gulf. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney indicated today in Spain that the Bush administration has not ruled out a plan to sell $20 billion in weapons to Saudi Arabia. A Washington Post report today says the administration wants to avoid a costly political battle with Congress during the Gulf crisis. Al Goodman reports from Madrid.
Cheney told a news conference in Madrid that speculation in Washington about the weapons deal for Saudi Arabia has mostly been inaccurate. He said he expected sales of additional armaments to the Saudis because of the legitimate security needs of our friends. Tens of thousands of American troops have been rushed to Saudi Arabia since Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. The Washington Post reported that the size of the Saudi weapons plan concerns some Congress members who said it could upset the balance of power in the Middle East. But Cheney said that F-15 fighter jets and M-60 tanks already have been sent to Saudi Arabia under a presidential executive order since Iraq's invasion. Cheney was in Madrid for talks on Spanish cooperation for the embargo against Iraq. For National Public Radio, I'm Al Goodman in Madrid.
President Bush's son, Neil, has been named in a $200 million lawsuit filed Monday by federal regulators. The action accuses Bush and other members of the board of the failed Silverado savings and loan of gross negligence, adding that Silverado was the victim of sophisticated schemes and abuses by insiders. Neil Bush served on the board of the institution from August 1985 to August 88. The institution was seized by the government in December 1988, costing taxpayers an estimated $1 billion in losses. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed lower, falling 6 points. This is Fresh Air. We have an interview with actor Jeff Goldblum coming up. There's a new CD featuring portraits by the late composer Virgil Thomson. The portraits are short musical character studies he wrote throughout his career. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says the portraits are really self-portraits.
Virgil Thomson composed musical portraits for 60 of his nearly 93 years, beginning in 1928. He was probably inspired by the Free Association literary portraits of his friend Gertrude Stein, who wrote the extraordinary librettos to two of Thomson's three operas, Four Saints in Three Acts and The Mother of Us All. According to Thomson's biographer, pianist Anthony Tomasini, who seems to be the guiding spirit behind this recording, Thomson composed his portraits from life, sketching his friends as they sat for him. Later, as many as 50 years later, he would finish the composition. He wrote 147 portraits in all. Here's one of the most delightful, which Thompson titled Dora Maar, or The Presence of Picasso. Maar was Picasso's lover, and Picasso accompanied her while she sat for Thompson on May 8, 1940. Obviously, he got into the portrait, Thompson said. So strong a character couldn't be in a room without being noticed. Picasso's bass line intrudes on the more feminine theme. Composing portraits allowed Thompson to pull in a wide variety of forms and styles, from fanfares to fugues, from tangos and waltzes to hymn tunes and parade music. The pieces are real character studies, and yet, like Thompson's early second piano sonata, they all reflect his own personality, a mercurial but always elegant combination of the cosmopolitan and the homespun. The best-known subjects among the Thompson portraits included on this recording are Aaron Copland, author Jane Bowles, and Gertrude Stein's friend and companion, Alice B. Toklas. Here's Anthony Tomasini playing part of her quirky but tender portrait. Tomasini has gathered some splendid musicians to perform the generous selection on this album, more than 30-odd portraits. Violinist Sharon Leventhal, who is half of the violin marimba duo Marimelin, is Tomasini's partner for 9 of the portraits, including 3 exuberantly arranged for violin and piano by Stravinsky's close friend, violinist Samuel Dushkin. Leventhal and flute player Fenwick Smith of the Boston Symphony team up for Thompson's Serenade for Flute and Violin, and Smith also plays a portrait Thompson wrote for solo flute. Oboist Frederick T. Cohen, bassoonist Ronald Harutunian, and Boston Symphony cellist Jonathan Miller perform in other portraits. Composer Scott Wheeler, who is also the subject of one of Thompson's portraits, arranged 5 of them for all the musicians participating on this disc. His delightful Northeastern suite thoroughly captures the spirit of Thompson. The production of this collection of his portraits began while Thompson was still alive. Now it's a wonderful memorial and a loving tribute. Let's close with Virgil Thompson's mock solemn 1984 portrait of Anthony Tomasini, called Tony Tomasini, Major Chords. Tomasini is again the pianist. He's also a music critic. Even he would have to be pleased with the authenticity of this performance and of the whole album.
George Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Virgil Thompson, Portraits and Self-Portraits, is on the Northeastern label. This is Fresh Air. Jeff Goldblum's screen roles have ranged from a People magazine reporter in The Big Chill to a rock critic in Between the Lines. He was a rapist in Death Wish, a biker magician in Nashville, and he had a small part in Woody Allen's film Annie Hall as a man who forgot his mantra. Goldblum gained the greatest attention and critical praise in David Cronenberg's remake of The Fly. Goldblum starred as a scientist who turns into an insect. In Goldblum's new comedy, The Tall Guy, he plays the straight man to an egomaniacal British comic. After the comic fires him, he's cast as the Elephant Man in an absurd musical version of the play. Goldblum doesn't have a singing role, but I asked him if he could sing an excerpt of one of the songs.
I know the finale goes, I'm John Merrick, you know, except I've got, the makeup is a little more elephantine, and I've got a big ear and kind of a little bit of a trunk, and I'm in bed in the hospital, and I finally die away, and and the chorus sings, up soars his soul, fleeing this world of tears. Somewhere up in heaven, there's an angel with big ears. An angel with big ears. Da 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 da. Curtain, you know, like that.
That's really wonderful. You don't remember any of Mr. Disgusting, do you?
Oh, let me see. Roll up, roll up. The tent is busting. Here he comes, Mr. Disgusting. It's, you know, like the beginning at when the Elephant Man when there was in that carnival, you know. That's it.
That's really great. You know, I think the movies that I know you best in have a lot to do with ego. For instance, in Between the Lines, you're really arrogant. In The Big Chill, you're really arrogant. In The Fly, you're kind of arrogant in the first half. You have kind of low self-esteem in the new film, The Tall Guy. Is ego something you feel you can really understand, both sides of it, the insecure side and the arrogant side?
Yes, I can. Me? I can, yeah. I don't usually talk about it in terms of ego, but yeah, I mean, I know what low self-esteem difficulties are, you know, and I know about feeling exultant and, you know, I'll tell you, there's something, and it's kind of mournful, there's something in my character at this point that I think was passed on through a troubling childhood in some ways, as long as you're asking about this stuff, that's competitive, sometimes unnecessarily competitive. So I either feel, you know, less than somebody or better than somebody. It's difficult, but I'm trying to control it and feel good about myself.
What was high school like for you when you were young?
Oh, high school. Well, you know, I had some uncomfortable years in there. You know, I felt like I was happy and very kind of extroverted up until like seventh grade. I just loved life and nature, and I was already flirtatious, and it was just great. Then I don't know, between seventh and tenth grades, I started to have this deep need for some larger life and some realer form of expression, because I wasn't getting it in high school, and I wasn't turning it into a place where I could shine, you know, and I felt kind of isolated.
You gave a great performance in the movie The Fly, which was directed by David Cronenberg. And you play a scientist who accidentally crosses his chromosomes with those of a fly during an experiment. And I want to play a scene from shortly after the experiment. you're changing, but you really think that you're changing for the better, and you're very excited about it. You don't realize you're actually changing into a fly. You're having a cup of coffee, and you're talking about how great you feel and how excited you are as you keep putting more and more sugar in your coffee and getting more and more manic.
I'm beginning to think that the sheer process of being taken apart atom by atom and put back together again, why, it's like coffee being put through a filter. It's somehow a purifying process. It's purified me. It's cleansed me. And I'll tell you, I think it's going to allow me to realize the personal potential I've been neglecting all these years, that I've been obsessively pursuing goal after goal. You know, I just don't think I've ever given me a chance to be me. But, of course, interestingly, at the exact same moment that I achieved what will probably prove to be my life's work, that's the moment when I started being the real me, finally. I mean, what an accomplishment. But what have I really done, though? All I've done is say to the world, let's go! Move! Catch me if you can. Waiter!
I really love that scene. You almost start to sound like Irwin Corey, Professor Irwin Corey, in the middle of it, because you're just talking so quickly and it's not meaning anything. Is any of that ad-libbed?
I'll tell you, half of it is, I could tell you where, but it's somewhere around half or a third or two-thirds is scripted and then dotted. And I kept thinking as I studied the script before, I know we're going to come to that scene and we're going to go on, because it's as if, you know, the scene the script implies I kind of go on. I should know what else I'm going to say. And nothing came to me till the day before, the night before, I think. And I just sat there and wrote kind of the second half of that out. And then the next day didn't really even tell him about it, but said, okay, let's shoot it. And I just kept going like that, kept going. And so a lot of that's mine.
Yeah. Can you describe a little bit what kind of prosthetics and makeup you had to wear during the latter parts of The Fly, when you were more fully metamorphosized?
What it was in the final stages, it took like 5 hours in the morning to do. It was a suit that was all, you know, that I'd had made from a mold of me, and that was all built up and, of course, colored and you know, harried up and stuff, that was from my neck to my ankles. That was very difficult to put on, very hot, and then they'd attach some feet to that and glue those on, and then paint the seams to blend it in. And then on my head there was there was a big collar piece, and then there was a face piece, and then a big cauliflower head piece, and they'd glue it on, and then blend it all in, and it took about 5 hours.
The director of The Fly, David Cronenberg, almost uses the metamorphosis into a fly as a metaphor for terminal illness, and you end up looking very diseased toward the end of the movie. And I was wondering if it was ever disturbing to look at yourself in the mirror with the makeup on.
You know, the whole movie was disturbing. I mean, I did have to come to grips with dying, and so, you know, I try to act, and the kind of acting I like, I know I like to see, is the kind where the actor, you know, has some real experience of the part and lives it through. So in some ways, I knew I wanted to, you know, go through that sad experience of getting a disease and dying and losing the person I love, and just when all my work is working out. And so it was disturbing, yeah. And so I would try to look in the mirror and feel that it was real, and it was disturbing. It would be more disturbing if I were really dying. I wouldn't want to die.
The first film, I'm not sure there's the first, one of the first films that you were in was Death Wish with Charles Bronson.
Right, that's right.
And you were one of the, was it delivery boys who rapes Bronson's wife?
Exactly.
This is the whole setup for the whole Death Wish theme, the whole revenge theme. It's been years. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say we kill his wife and rape his daughter. That's right.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I haven't seen it since it came out. What are your memories of that scene, of shooting that scene?
Oh, it was a brutal scene. It was the first movie I ever auditioned for. I was thrilled to have it. And you know, it had a lot of rage in it, so I remember sort of, you know, relishing that in a certain way. And Michael Winner, the director, I was coming up the stairs in one shot, and I think the first thing we did, and we started to rehearse it, and he just for camera, and he yelled at the top of his lungs, "Goldblum, start acting now!" He was English, you know, and that's about all the direction he gave me, so it was disturbing, but I enjoyed the part.
You have played opposite Gina Davis, who is also your wife. Are you married?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, your wife. Yeah. Is it easier to star opposite somebody in a film when it's your wife? Or does that add certain difficulties?
Oh, I don't know that there's a rule about it, but with me and Gina, with Gina and I, it's been great. I mean, the Fly, you know, we weren't married when we did that, and we were living together, but doing that together allowed us to discover each other in a whole new way and discover that we worked well together, and it was great to be passionate about this thing outside of ourselves. It was really fun, and then Earth Girls Are Easy, you know, was just kind of fun and light. So there's no rule about it. Our relationship has constantly kind of changed and is changing. So it could be easy or hard depending on the time and the project.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much.
Jeff Goldblum's new comedy, The Tall Guy, just opened in 27 cities. It opens in more cities on October 5th. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we have a report on the escalating rhetoric in the tensions between Iraq and the United States, among others. Also, a special report by NPR's John Burnett on the near sweatshop conditions in which many workers in the garment industry work on the Texas side of the U.S.-Mexican border. And a report from Odessa, Texas, about the extremely intense pressure that's felt there on the high school football team. And we talk with an East German woman, Ruth Wiedemann, and we've checked back with over the past several weeks on the economic turmoil in East Berlin as unification approaches.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday through next Thursday, PBS is presenting an 11-hour documentary series called The Civil War, a series that was 5.5 years in the making. TV critic David Bianculli has a preview.
Before the war, it was said the United States are. Grammatically, it was spoken that way and thought of as a collection of independent states. And after the war, it was always the United States is, as we say today, without being self-conscious at all. And that sums up what the war accomplished. It made us and is.
That's author and historian Shelby Foote, who's the most prominent and entertaining talking head in Ken Burns' new documentary series, The Civil War. Foote is the most wonderful storyteller on TV since Joseph Campbell was interviewed by Bill Moyers. But Foote is only one of many secret weapons in this particular Civil War. One of the best things about this series is what it doesn't include. There's not one reconstructed battle in the entire 11 hours. Instead, Burns pans and zooms his camera across thousands of photographs from the period. To capture the mood of the war, he visits former battle sites at the times of day those battles took place, a beautiful and very artistic touch. Burns also relies heavily on letters written at the time, not only by generals and presidents, but by everyday soldiers. These letters are read by unseen actors, while period music and appropriate sound effects play in the background. It's a lot like the approach used in the HBO documentary Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, and makes the Civil War seem just as immediate. The voices heard in the Civil War include those of Garrison Keillor, Kurt Vonnegut, Sam Waterston, Morgan Freeman, Julia Harris, Arthur Miller, Jason Robards, and the series narrator, David McCulloch. But the words, even more than the speakers, are what make this documentary so powerful. Listen to part of this letter, written by a Northern soldier to his wife before the Battle of Bull Run. Actor Paul Roebling reads it.
Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. The soft breeze fans your cheek. It shall be my breath, or the cool air, your throbbing temple. It shall be my spirit passing by.
That may be history, but it's also poetry. And the same is true of all of the Civil War. Ken Burns is a filmmaker who can take you back. Shelby Foote is a storyteller who can convince you he was there. The Civil War is a show to watch and tape and treasure. Please don't miss it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Sue Spolin and Russ Ann Bucci. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, tenor saxophonist Stan Getz tells us about his life in music. Also, a talk with novelist and short story writer Richard Ford. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.